Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. Conservatism is more an instinct than an idea, but it's the instinct that I think we all ultimately share, at least if we're happy in this world. If the instinct to hold on to what we love, to protect it from degradation and violence, and to build our lives around it. For us now in this country, it is at least the heritage of political order and our way of doing things, the natural way of being in this country, where we belong, and defending it as our home. And I think that is the ultimate root of the conservative position. So wrote Roger Scruton, who has been a moral and an intellectual inspiration equally to me and my guest today, Kathy Gingell, who founded The Conservative Woman. She began it with Laura Perrins, and it's grown exponentially from its original creation. The events of the last few weeks, as we record, have seen our major cities taken over by protest marches. Our own civic rituals surrounding Remembrance Sunday have been undermined and threatened. The police have adopted different standards of policing crowds that depend upon colour and religion, with white and Christian being more harshly and punitively dealt with. Kathy explains her motivation involves wanting to tell and discover the truth. And she joins me now. Kathy, hello and welcome. This is great. It's so nice to talk to you. Thank you for making the time to do this. I've discovered you from afar as I've tried to write for The Conservative Woman and sort of slip myself into the very illustrious band of authors that you have, not entirely with success so far. But what you've done with The Conservative Woman and what you've done with your own writing has really been formidably impressive. Can you just tell the listeners a bit about both yourself, the journey you've been on, and also about The Conservative Woman, and then we'll discuss the events of the moment.
Well, hello, Gavin, and thanks very much for having me on. It's a delight to talk to you. It was a delight to meet you for the first time the other day. Well, my elder sister said to me in the middle of the sort of whole lockdown debacle and over vaccination, well, the trouble is with you, Kathy, you've always been a contrarian. Well, that is probably true.
Oh, good.
And I think, I don't know why, I'm probably the only one in my family who is, but I have always felt quite driven morally, both to recognise the truth, to know when something's wrong, and then to be brave enough to say it.
Let me stop you just a second, because I think this is a really important point. I'm also called a contrarian. And the first person, the time I heard it, I thought, somehow that has implications of being unnecessarily difficult. Mm. But I don't think I am unnecessarily difficult, and I don't think you are too. I think it's a necessary difficulty that comes from other people not telling the truth. Not to turn this onto me, but to ask you to bounce this back to you. I've always been afraid of going mad, and I worry about the truth. And holding on to the truth is one of the ways in which I feel I can do something about keeping madness at bay. The truth, therefore, matters to me for a whole series of reasons, including passionate spiritual religious ones. You might or might not be a contrarian, but aren't you somebody who is actually profoundly concerned for telling the truth?
Well, I think so. I've come to that now. And my prayers to God are always to say, am I sure of what I'm doing? Tell me. I mean, I don't want to be pursuing something obsessionally. So that's my prayer for absolute guidance about that purpose for my life, to be able to tell the truth and be brave enough to tell the truth. But way back, this has come to me much later, and probably even in the last few years, especially, well, probably since I set up The Conservative Woman, but longer than that. But earlier on, where it came from me psychologically is recognizing when I felt uncomfortable about things. And usually I found that when I felt uncomfortable about things, I was uncomfortable about something that people were accepting, but was actually wrong. And it seemed so awful to say the word wrong, but where people were deceiving themselves, where there was a delusion or an illusion, or people want things to be all right. So many people want things to be all right. My biggest one, earliest one probably would have been, I was in the universities 1969 to 1974 with 2 degrees. So I was very much in the sort of sex liberation, drugs, rock and roll culture. Well, I was pretty slow on the sex liberation and got quite bullied about that, I would say. I mean, the sort of comment I had from the boyfriends of other girls around, oh, that's the only virgin left on the corridor at my Cambridge College, which is pretty grim. I learned to ride that, and it was sometimes quite lonely. I also realized, without knowing very much about it, that the peer pressure at that time to smoke cannabis, it was peer pressure.
Sure.
And I knew that was wrong. And that, I think, was even before I'd done my social psychology thing that showed really a great course I did for part of my degree on exactly how peer pressure works, whether the Stanley Milgram experiments or the group of people who are set up to say a line is two lines of the same length and there's one candidate who's the victim in this experiment who gradually agrees that the two lines that are the same length that they aren't because of the force of the pressure of the group about. So I was very aware of this. However, the next bout came with having my babies, going back to work very quickly after my first child, 11 weeks, because I thought that's what I was meant to do, because I was told by lots of gurus around that that was fine, actually from Claire Rayner to Penelope Leach, who I was then producing on a television show that I was editor of, and finding that my body and my everything was rebelling in me. I was in a state of panic, literal panic, and rushing home to get to the baby at lunchtime. I did a mental 9 months of this and then gave up. From then on, I couldn't understand this idea of why in our, this was a merciless society that was making us outsource our babies, either because of financial reasons or because of ideological reasons. So that was the beginning of my great battle. I set up an organization called Full Time Mothers, very much, you know, swimming against the tide. I'm not a passionate advocate now. I just say what's wrong. I've learned that. I went into the playground passionately advocating to all the other mothers that they must join my new full-time mothers, and they looked at me aghast. And I was an embarrassment. Who is she? Who is this Mary Whitehouse? Who is this old-fashioned woman? And they were all pretending they had dual careers.
Oh, really?
It's like the columnist who writes one column a week. I am the great feminist, and they're all spouting this feminist stuff while they wrote one column a week and were at home with a husband who earned money. You know, so I began to see hypocrisy, Gavin, and that's what, over a period of time, took me more appearance to setting up Conservative Woman. That, more than anything else, plus watching over the period of Tony Blair came in, this wonderful lie about consensus and the wonderful lie about the third way. And it was non-stop expansion of the state and into our private family lives, the state taking over, the nationalisation of children. And nobody else, apart from Laura and me and a few others, seemed very shocked by this revolution. It was just happening, pushed by feminists.
So this is extremely interesting because it's taken me a very long time to be able to say that I think that feminism is one of the most noxious and problematic philosophical forces in our society. Because if you say that as a man, everyone says, well, you're just a misogynist. But I imagine it's difficult for different reasons for men and women to say it. But essentially what you're saying is that both the misuse of sex and the abuse of power through peer pressure were the two cultural phenomena that were pushing you into a corner from which you rebelled. Can I just ask, just for the sake of curiosity, that in terms of the Conservative Woman, is this conservative as in culturally conservative? I want to conserve that which is good in Christendom and good for humanity. Or is it conservative as in politically conservative? We don't like the socialists and you have to choose politically between us and the socialists that choose, or a mixture of both. Which is it?
No, it's cultural. I have to say I set this up with a very remarkable woman called Laura Perrins, who managed to hit the nail on the head in the most brilliant way, attacking Nick Clegg on his great, apparently enlightened childcare policies, all the money just going for you to pay for somebody else to bring up the child, not the money going to you to choose how to use it. Social conservatism. We had abandoned the Conservative Party effectively by then. We absolutely believed in what Roger Scruton said, it takes generations to build something good and a minute to destroy it. And we were seeing destruction all around us already then. So we were quite radical, but equally we were economic liberals. And the message we tried to get across, have probably never succeeded, is to have economic liberalism, you must have social conservatism.
Yeah.
You can't have economic freedom and a wherewithal without trust, without loyalty, without contract, without social sanctions on behaviour. And what the Conservative Party lost, we took the worst of each of those worlds. we took forms of economic liberalism that haven't actually worked out as very liberal, you know, especially on public, some of the public services, sort of, I'd say, water and energy. I mean, I don't really want to get into that. I mean, fundamentally, I believe that each of us ought to be able to set up our own business and between us create the provisions that society needs. But there are ugly sides to that type of private world, we know. But as I say, Laura and I always felt in a good society, these would be tempered by a solid social conservatism. Basically, the Conservative Party just threw that in the rubbish bin.
That's very interesting and very helpful. And thank you so much for bringing Roger Scruton into it, because I think what that does is it locates us philosophically rather than politically. And as you quite rightly say, there is plenty of scope for being an economic liberal, and even to some extent, somebody committed to the ideals of the welfare state, so long as you have a platform of what I think I would then begin to talk about as being the inheritance of Christendom, all the values that Christianity, inspired by its Judeo heritage, brings to this are prerequisites for the Scrutonian philosophy. We could talk about Scruton and his semi-agnosticism, but you and I are both practicing Christians, and we see, I think, undoubtedly, we both see the faith as being the driver for these values. The moment you take that away, then the values begin to evaporate, or rather, they begin to give way before other values. Can we talk about Remembrance Sunday and the clash of cultures, or the clash of civilizations that we're facing at the moment, partly because it's very fresh, and partly because I think you probably have some things to say about it.
I suppose before I go on to the sort of very depressing news of Sunak sacking Suella Braverman this morning, that just about put me to rock bottom this morning, of a sort of representation of each time how wrong they go, I think I'd like to begin with a small image. I went to my local church for my remembrance service, so I didn't go up to the cenotaph. But I spoke to a girlfriend, a bit younger than me, but, you know, fully middle-aged towards going upwards, on the phone last night. And she said, Cathy, I'm so shocked. I got out at Westminster Tube to go to the cenotaph, because I do every year, and we were confronted by armed police. And she said, we then had to go through, have all our bags checked very slowly, and snake through what was fundamentally a corridor of police on either side of us, armed all the way. She said, we were middle-aged, white, middle-aged to elderly, and we were the ones who were being policed.
Yes.
And that made me realise that this is where we've been brought to. As everybody knows, there have been demonstrations, incitement to violence demonstrations of people who are not peace-loving, who are not law-abiding, all over the country and in London, maybe kept well away from the cenotaph. But we have paid the price for that. We are the ones who are policed. It's a bit bizarre. It's an anachronism. It's a perversity. Where were the police putting all those people through their bag checks before they went on the march, before they got on any... Nowhere. And this is not just. And she said, when I got there, she said it was finally so pitiful to watch these last remaining survivors from the Second World War, who we know, your parents will have fought. I don't know how old you are, but my father was a padre in the RAF. He was on a boat that was torpedoed. He was one of very few survivors. My mother worked in radar. And then when she married my father, you know, they were on the air bases. I found this so insulting and so hurtful. And when she told me this story, it actually made me want to cry. I thought, what have we come to, that the people who did the right thing are being penalised, are being marginalised, being policed, the police status for us. And it goes back, when I felt this before, when they put the ring of steel around Westminster after the Islamic attacks, I thought, they're putting a ring of steel around our democracy. They're keeping us away from it, yet they're not dealing with the Islamism that's behind it. And they still haven't. And we see today, they haven't at all. Diversity and inclusion is now a police state for us.
Well, we're back to the Orwellian challenge, that words were going to be used to imprison us, both politically and philosophically, that meant something entirely different. And I think one of the things that you and I would both say that we've been doing over the last few years is trying to express the integrity of ideas through words without having them constantly hijacked and turned inside out by our ideological opponents, whose intention was always to bring us to this point of, well, in my case, emasculation, I would call it, but ideological imprisonment, so that there's no longer shared language. I found it very difficult when I said to my son, I want to go to London, to the Cenotaph. And I looked on in the media, and essentially, I became described as a right-wing thug because I'm white and I want to go and protect or stand by or bear testimony at the Cenotaph. And there was no distinction made between indigenous English people who wanted to give to keep faith with their parents.
And more than indigenous English, people actually from all over the Commonwealth, they're even more criminal than we are if they speak the truth.
I've always been very moved by the way in which the Sikh contingent in the British Army played such a part. And when I was on the South Coast, I came across, there's a particular Sikh burial place for those who gave their lives fighting Hitler. So you're absolutely right. It is a Commonwealth thing. And I suppose by saying that, what we're trying to do is to say we're not racists because we're delighted that we shared a collegial fight against fascism with other races. But we are English and this is our country and we shouldn't have to be described as fascists. Because essentially, the real fascists are the people whose values align most closely with German nationalist socialist fascism appear to be the people marching for the destruction of the Jews under the banner of Islam, as far as I can tell. And yet they have the nerve to say to dismiss us and to silence us as if we were fascists.
And Suella Braverman gets sacked for actually speaking the truth on that. So any opposition from us has become bigotry. It was interesting, and even the trouble is the way the mainstream media will fall for a narrative. It was only until Tommy Robinson said he was coming to pay his respects or whatever and urged his followers to be peaceful. Well, they may or may not have been. I really don't know. I haven't followed it in that detail. But then it all got hijacked. What we're expecting is violence because of that. They'd completely ignored the incitement to violence, and that the media picks up on this narrative. This is one of my other things, Gavin. People don't really have very strong powers of critical thinking these days. I mean, they have lost the capacity to think on a basis of some sort of principled points about how you think and how critical reasoning works.
Let me ask you about the influence of the conservative woman, because I think this capacity to think and to read and to write the truth is really essential. I mean, at least in educational or intellectual terms, it's our last hope. There are people out there who are capable of being reasoned with, though increasingly few. And there are key people capable of writing the truth, though increasingly few. But the conservative woman publishes some of the better ones. What's your sense of, as you present on a literary platform for telling the truth, about the way in which people receive it? Are you growing? Are you diminishing? Are you experiencing persecution, discrimination, or support and growth? What is it like being somebody telling the truth?
We're very subject to cancellation. I mean, I was the keynote speaker at a conference that was due to be held in Liverpool on Saturday, the Great Resist Conference, and 2 days before the Holiday Inn cancelled the venue. I don't say that was just because of me. They'd attacked the whole notion of the Great Resist Conference that's set up by a very brave woman called Liz Phillips. And it was her third conference, and we managed to do it on Zoom. But it was awful. As a site, we're cancelled. We can't run Google ads. They've cancelled us. So we can't make any money from advertising. There was all this big fuss about Rumble and Russell Brand, but we were demonetized ages ago and nobody leapt to our defense or made a big fuss about it. I mean, Mark Stein is the only one who was summarily dismissed from GB News, who sort of took on our cause in any way. I was banned completely from Twitter for I don't know how long. I had temporary bans. I refused. What most people do is in the end they comply. They don't stick to the principle. So they'll have a tweet and Twitter will come on to your ex and say, this tweet is unacceptable. It's COVID misinformation. It's whatever. If you delete it, you can go back on. will unblock you. And then people delete the tweet and go back on. I always refused to do that because until it was deleted, that tweet sat there as my last tweet. And so people still could read it. It's a matter of principle again. Then finally, because I was an awkward one, I got banned altogether simply for a sympathetic, empathetic tweet to a vaccine injured woman. Even after Elon Musk came back, I took a while to get on. Oh, and then we were cancelled. This is the best one, Gavin. This is terribly funny. And we do believe, we have been told off under the sort of, what's it, that this came direct from Whitehall. And it got rather confirmed when the Telegraph broke another aspect of this story, though they never covered ours. Every mobile phone operator was told by the British Board of Film Censors, who do the adult classification for mobile phones, what they're allowed to put through, to ban our site. So for a period of about 5 months, it came up as an SSL, which looked like it was our fault the site had gone down. It took me and Emma, our wonderful website mistress, with some help initially, very good help from the Free Speech Union, to finally persuade the British Board of Film Censors to unblock us and to tell the mobile companies to unblock us.
Help me here, because I'm still trying to get my head round how it is that every single public organisation, as far as I can tell, has succumbed to the woke narrative, which is so untrue, contains so many internal contradictions, that I find it very difficult to believe that there are sane, educated people running it who can't see it. The British Board of Film Censors refused to accept conservative women.
I have to give David Austin his due. We sort of left him hanging about whether there was going to be, we were going to take it to court, or I can't remember what the thing is. What did Simon Dolan do? You do a judicial review. Until Laura and I both realised that our summers with our own families, and she's a mother of four, would be totally wrecked because we'd have to work on this every day because we have no money. And then I worried that my house would be up for the costs if we failed. And I told Free Speech Union, much as in principle I wanted to go ahead, I actually couldn't do it. I don't have a backer. And so David Austin was, so he did get in touch with me. And he's a very nice man. I got the impression, and this is out and loud, and he'll be able to say if I'm wrong, that he really didn't understand what had happened in his organisation at all about us. And I kept saying, you know, David, people accuse me of being Mary Whitehouse. You have got us banned on grounds of inappropriateness, content inappropriate for under 18-year-olds. Have you seen what under 18-year-olds can get on their mobile phones through Twitter, through everything else? I said, we're so proper. That's what people complain about us, is because we're so proper and old-fashioned. Anyway, he sort of looked a bit bemused, but then he opened his mind to it. And there, but we still then, we found out afterwards, and I'm sure he did not instruct it, that they trawled hundreds of thousands of the comments on our site in order to find three or four that they could class as racist, homophobic, whatever, you know the stuff, Islamophobic.
Kathy, before you go on, just in brackets, because, you know, I'm constantly trying to make sure that I've got a grip on the world we're in. My sense has been that people under 45 are on the whole invulnerable to the kind of conversation that we're having. That there's a sort of line somewhere about 45. Someone above 45 might have escaped the level of propaganda and heavy-handed educational treatment that you and I didn't receive initially, though we grew up in the backwash of it, but that under 45, it's almost impossible to talk to people who were educated 20 years ago or so in the universities, and that these are the people who are militantly looking to close down the old order that we represent. Do you think, is that neurotic, or do you think that's accurate?
Well, I don't quite agree. I think it's true. It's a disaster with the education system. But I would see the guilty men as people of being nearer our age, Gavin. I mean, if I look at the people, you know, you take Mark Carney at the Bank of England. David Austin was probably younger than me, but I'm sure well over 50. But if I look at the people, I think what happened was there were some very well-educated people of our generation who were leftist and statist and secularist and hubristic and arrogant. And really, under the Tony Blair government, they absolutely had their moment. And there were endless trusts, NHS trusts for them to become the chairperson of, endless Oxford colleges. They've all gone. Really, these people are really absolutely the gatekeepers and have had absolutely allowed it, this takeover. And they are mainly leftists. And then and they're also very assiduous for power. It's a very interesting thing. And they like power in the public space. So they like public organisations. Now, you or me would probably never put ourselves forward to be the head of an NHS trust. I can tell you we're just as qualified as many of them out there doing it. We would not put ourselves forward to be local mayor, to do all these things. But it attracts a type of person. So the bigger the state gets, the more power they get. And then it works. Then, of course, the other side to this is when you look at the NatWest Bank and what happened to Farage, you look at the rainbow flags above the banks on Pride Week and all these major old-fashioned institutes. You look at the law courts, you look at the judiciary. This has been coming a long time.
There are a number of lawyers in my family. My father was a barrister. One of my nieces was telling me that in order to qualify to be considered for appointment to the bench, you have to fill in a DIE qualification piece of paper. In other words, you have to prove your credential. You have to prove your progressive credentials in terms of left-wing ideology, in order to be even considered for appointment. So that the only people who are appointed to the judiciary in our country are people who are firmly ideologically contained within that particular philosophy. Well, that in itself is a form. So, you know, I used to believe in the law. And that's a form of scrutiny and social engineering that is so radical and, of course, strikes at the roots of the whole integrity of the English legal system.
It's a long march through the institutions, plus the diversity and inclusion stuff. So it's socialism plus those other things. So it's invidious. So in a lot of professions, especially nursing and medical, I think the diversity quotient to meet it is so high that without doubt you'll get a drop in fundamental standards. So you get a drop in standards once competition and selection on merit is removed. You also open a way to not very intelligent thinking.
It's a vicious circle. I mean, Peterson is very good about this, explaining that one of the great virtues of the right is that it pursues competence rather than ideological conformity. So, I mean, ideological conformity inevitably yes. produces morons, if I can be rude for a moment. I mean, there must be a more sophisticated word.
Your point about the young people is absolutely correct. I just wanted to say that I don't think we can blame them altogether. I don't mean blame. Blame's the wrong word. But the other thing that I quite like to come back to before we finish, the bit that I've never been able to communicate to anybody apart from a few sympathetic people is the revolution in childcare. You're teaching conformity, you're stopping listening to their feelings, you're stopping empathy. We had a childcare revolution in this country that took place under our eyes without anyone really, apart from the few of us, questioning it. And it was a change. The most recent figures is the majority of mothers of under 4-year-olds, I think, are now in full-time work. And a very, very high number. They have very little choice. This is not a blame game I'm playing. And they're being impoverished. I mean, they're on a treadmill. These young couples are on an absolute treadmill, trying to do the best for their children, having to put them into daycare. You know, if the woman's mother's in a profession, she might get a year's maternity leave, but she has to go back after a year. If she's not in a profession, she won't get that amount of maternity leave. I've had mothers describing to me, you know, their child crying for 3 months of the first 3 months of every morning. Imagine what this is like for a mother taking her baby to cry. Other mothers have told me, including my daughter-in-law, when they looked in the baby care room in these day centres, they were so horrified. They came away and thought they'd get a childminder if they could, an accredited childminder who they knew as an individual whose home they could go into. They were so shocked by the baby rooms. Now, none of this gets talked about. I've seen girls in Battersea Park with 6 children on leading reins. I mean, they're walking them like dogs. So they're breaking the relationship between the mother and the child, the family and the child, well, that's when you get your potential for the type of unfeelingness, lack of empathy, belief in euthanasia. We're killing empathy and feeling. They have to find another identity, and the identity is always going to be in the crowd of whatever victim group they think they're in.
We're going to end in a moment, so let me take you to something more hopeful, I think. Two things I want to talk about. One is going underground, and the other is home education. One of the things I've been impressed with within the Catholic community that I've entered fairly recently is the commitment to home education and the way in which the Catholic Church is providing curricular structure and a culture in which, if you can survive on one salary, home education becomes possible. My guess is that home education will be expanded so that it becomes an act of the community. That seems to me to be one obvious way in which one resists the dead hand of the state as it seeks to kidnap our children and their minds. What about the implications of having to go underground? In other words, one of the things that I used to do in the 1980s was smuggle Samizdat in and out of the Soviet Union, where all the kind of values that we're talking about happened underground between people who trusted each other. Do you see a time coming when the readership of the conservative woman would have to be consenting adults knowing one another in a kind of circle of trusted people rather than, but because you will have been closed down in public, we will have the internet and the normal pathways of electronic communication closed to us. It seems to me the stranglehold that's beginning to develop is not going to stop or be reversed anytime soon.
I fear it. Things are moving much faster than I could have ever anticipated. I mean, I'm trying to do it, and I'll just put out a little plea to anyone who's listening. Please join our mailing list. There's no paywall to anyone who's listening. I need to expand my email list at the very
least. Exactly that, yes.
I don't know what to say. I never thought I'd say. I'm always reminded of that wonderful film, Fahrenheit 2000, do you remember it, with Julie Christie? And we're in the totally Orwellian dystopia. And in order to protect our culture and our heritage, each person has to learn a book off by heart. And you see them all walking in the woods on wherever they're living. reciting the book. And I'm terrified because my memory is so bad and I can't recite anything. And I think, I look at my age now and I think, who's going to hold this for future generations? And we have to have paper. I just told my son yesterday, just get paper copies. Get paper copies again. We need fax machines again.
Yes, I agree. I've stopped buying off. I mean, I buy Kindle because I'm very grateful to be able to read as I walk around. But I'm doing exactly the same. When I can afford it, I instantly buy the hardback copy physically because they will at some point take away my access to Kindle.
But Gavin, I'm sure you've got the books that matter. I think I've got a lot of books. I mean, I'm so glad I never threw anything away on each move. And even all these dirty old paperbacks I've got, I'm now sort of getting them out tenderly.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think I have got the books that matter, but one never has enough of the books that matter. There are always more books. And one discovers, thank God, that more books are being written that matter. Well, I think this notion of people like us expanding their email lists, and I think probably even the geographical snail mail addresses is very important because, as you quite rightly say, one doesn't know the point at which the rug will be pulled. And if there's a gap between those people we can communicate independently with and those people who want access to us, in that gap, too many people will fall. So I think that's out of this conversation, it's probably a useful thing to be able to say. I want to ask you one more thing to root this back in what for us is a Catholic, but let's call it a Christian worldview for the moment. I keep on wanting to look over my shoulder at the people who run the church, amongst whom I was sort of almost numbered, at least as an Anglican, and say to them, you're not doing your job. You are the guardians of religious Scrutonianism. You are the guardians of the Judeo-Christian faith. And it should not be left to people like contrarians, like Kathy Gingell and Gavin Ashenden and our friends. It should not be left to us to do this, partly because we've been deplatformed institutionally, but you continue to have a platform. If you had a message to the to either the bishops or the Church of England or to the Catholic hierarchy, what would you want to say to them?
I would say put your money back into opening churches and employing clergymen, and take your money away from political lobbying, climate activism, woke activism, diversity and inclusion activism. They have changed from becoming a ministry into, they've abandoned their flock, completely abandoned their flock. Shame on them. I mean, it does, it makes me feel very angry. I can't do this calmly.
I don't think you should do it calmly.
They want to be social justice warriors. Well, there's no justice in what they're doing. And I don't feel, it sounds so awful, I don't feel they're Christian.
I think there'll be other people who are inclined to agree with you.
We write about it weekly on The Conservative Woman. They you know, I'm sure the Archbishop has it banned from his officers, our website, because he's always under attack, which doesn't sort of feel right in some ways. But what does one do?
Well, you're not attacking the office, you're attacking the holder of the office, and you're asking the holder of the office to be more congruent with the integrity of the office that he's been given, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to do. Cathy, thank you so much for taking the time to talk this through. It's been wonderful to discover that we're on the same page and fighting the same battles. And I know a lot of people will be enormously encouraged by what you said, and you're bound to get a good many more readers, and I hope email addresses as well. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Gavin.